Our next guest, Thelma Awori, is going to tell us what has been the impact of transnational corporations and their investments in the continent of Africa. She's a former Assistant Secretary General at the United Nations, responsible for the UNDP's Bureau for Africa. Before that, she was Deputy Director of the UNDP's Policy Bureau for a three-year period, representing the UNDP and the UN system in Zimbabwe. She's a graduate of Harvard University and University of California, Berkeley, and now working as an independent consultant while pursuing her doctorate at Columbia University. Thelma, you have the floor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Oh.
Now we have
a different problem.
Turn this one off and that one on. Or I can just pass this one over.
It just worked.
This one works. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Try again.
Can you hear me now?
She's speaking loudly. It's not
I'm
that.
I'm speaking fairly
Try
loudly.
Try to go back the way you just had it with his mic.
Can you hear me? Yes, you can hear
perfect.
Me now. Okay, very good. Because I don't have a good voice today, and I'm representing a sister and a friend who was supposed to be here, who also fell ill because she didn't have a good voice. She's suffering from bronchial asthma that she got from staying in a hotel where there was a lot of renovation and dust in the carpets. And she's had to go back without coming to speak to you. She called and asked if I would represent her, and now I'm glad I didn't turn her down, because I see that the African representation in this room is very, very small and limited largely to the people I invited to come. I only see two Africans in here besides myself. Maybe I'm not counting enough. So I don't know what kind of image we are giving to the rest of the world. But that's just to preface by saying that I do not have a major presentation to make. I'm going to make 3 points. My first point is to tell you that in Africa, we are moving into a new phase of the privatization of the plunder of Africa. We've moved out of the stage of plunder by the state when we ended colonialism. And we have a new fight to deal with private plunder, which has justified itself by this neoliberal ideology of liberalization and deregulation of international financial markets and the economies of the African countries themselves. And you know that this policy is the centerpiece of the structural adjustment and reform programs that are imposed upon African nations by the very efficient institutions of your new globalization order. We also have to deal with international trafficking networks in mineral resources. Look at what's happening in Sierra Leone and Liberia, and why do you think that conflict lasts so, so long? Somebody must be benefiting when conflict lasts so long. We have to deal with the use of front companies for large transnational corporations and the privatization of plunder and pillage in Africa for profits leaves little hope that the resources of Africa will be available for African development. This whole system that we have, this new system we have, whereby states are supporting their private corporations to go out and plunder other states, it's really has become very, very efficient. Look at the alliance between Enron and the United States government to put pressure on the Mozambican government to make sure that Enron's front company had access to the oil that has been discovered in Mozambique. In fact, a very senior member of the former Clinton government wrote a letter to the Mozambican president to say that if Enron could not be given access to the oil in Mozambique, there was no way he could justify the use of $100 million of U.S. aid to Mozambique. And these corporations are backed up by their very loyal servants and efficient instruments, the World Bank, the IMF, the World Trade Organization. You had just about finished your campaign on 50 years is enough, and you didn't realize that they were planning another instrument, the World Trade Organization, which would be even tougher than the World Bank and IMF. And these institutions enforce and impose policies on African governments that actually lead to death and destruction in Africa. You also have the coalition between international criminal networks and corrupt national African governments. And so what we have now to deal with is what I would call the strangulation of Africa, where her very life breath is being choked out of her, and her voice is just limited to a peep squeak. I'm having problems with my voice right now. But if you want to know that it's very hard right now to get many African intellectuals to be involved in this kind of advocacy work, or to say things that are anti the World Bank or even their governments. Why? Because many of them depend on these large institutions for consultancies and jobs and for employment within these large systems, where they hope to be able to get a good education for their children and to get foreign exchange, which they can use to invest at home in their villages. I consider this to be violence. The Swiss president said, well, he was very happy that the eye on Davos was not a violent response to the WEF. But I consider this to be a very serious kind of violence. It's a white collar violence, and it looks dignified because it's done by good people and therefore tends to look good. But it should be considered for the violence that it is, because it also causes death and destruction. I want to impress on you that with the exposure that Africa has to this new globalization and the system that goes with it, there is no way, absolutely no way, that Africa will be able to meet the agreement to reduce poverty by one half by the year 2015. There's just absolutely no way that will happen. Africa has become, and increasingly so, the dumping ground for a lot of hazardous waste. Of the 100 to 300 million tons of waste produced annually, 50 million of this is shipped to Africa. In the late 80s, we discovered that several transnational corporations had covertly made contracts with several African countries to dump their waste in Africa. And now that has been discovered and some action has been taken against it, we find new forms of dumping in the form of recycling. I think one of the big forms of dumping, which looks good, is the dumping of used vehicles by Japan in Africa. And it looks very legitimate because many Africans buy these vehicles because they're very happy to have a cheap vehicle that they can use. This saves Japan the whole problem of having to take care of her own need for people to change cars often and what she's going to do with that waste. But I wonder how Africa is going to be able to manage the waste that will come out of all of those used cars and used tires and all of those. That will be a development challenge for Africa. And in the unbridled pursuit of profits, we've seen millions of children die from Nestles, and I don't want anyone to forget Nestles, because it was unforgivable what Nestles did. Promotion of their substitution for breast milk, which caused many, many millions of children to die of diarrhea and unclean water. We don't want the pharmaceutical companies to forget what they did with Depo-Provera, experimenting with this on African women. We don't want the tobacco companies to forget that we know that they're targeting youth right now especially now that there's a lot of campaign against them in the developing countries. We know that many of the seed companies are introducing hybrid seeds into countries like Kenya. And these seeds make it very difficult for farmers to really get out of poverty. Farmers might be made to think that they're going to get higher yields, but it means that they cannot use some of those same seeds to replant next year. They have to buy new seeds, they have to buy fertilizers, and this makes them continuously dependent on the big seed companies that come from this side of the world. The privatization of water is another problem that we're having, which is a big problem for women, especially, who live in urban areas. When you privatize water, private companies do not make that extra effort to get water to people who can't afford to pay for it. So if you look in many of the urban areas, access to clean water is very, very poor, and the quality of water is dangerously bad. And of course, the biggest and most outrageous affront that we've had to deal with of late is the fight that South Africa had to fight against the giant pharmaceutical companies to make sure that the millions of people in South Africa who are infected with HIV/AIDS could have access to drugs. The international patent rights of many of these transnational corporations will of course make Africans more and more dependent, because if we want anything now, first they will come and they will take our raw materials and they will make drugs out of them, and then they will have the patent rights, and if we want access to those drugs, we have to pay great amounts of money from them. So besides the harm that's being done to people as people, our already stretched national budgets will have to be diverted into systems to monitor these transnational corporations. We have to get the laboratories, we have to get the databases, we have to get the equipment, we have to get the legal frameworks in place that will help to protect us from the greed and the profiteering of these corporations. If I just want to give you a short example, if the chairman will permit, of my little village where I live. I was there in the summer, and I had said to the person who manages my little 15-acre place, try to ensure that we have enough chickens, because Christmas will come and the whole family will be here and we'll have to depend on those chickens to eat. When I got there at Christmas time, we didn't have any chickens. And I said, well, what happened to the chickens? Why don't we have any chickens? And she said, well, madame, you know, when the aeroplane comes, all the chickens die. We live right next to a swamp that produces rice. And this company, which the swamp has been privatized, the company that is producing rice there now has decided that the birds are a pest and brings in a plane that flies and drops certain chemicals to kill the birds. And of course, the chickens as well die because they are foul as well. But just imagine killing all those beautiful birds. So all of these resources that we have will have to be diverted away from giving people basic social services. And we definitely will be unable to reduce poverty by half by 2015. Some of our best minds will have to be diverted to advocacy, the kind of advocacy that I'm doing, that other people are doing. And the concept of development will have to be expanded to include the fight against criminality. And that is the basis for, you know, this kind of what I would call clean terrorism, because it's surgical. Yes. Conflicts in Africa are fueled by profits in the arms trade and in competition to gain access to resources such as oil. I hope you know that Africa is the second largest provider of American oil behind the Middle East, and investment could exceed $10 billion by 2003. And for all of this, there's a tremendous lack of transparency. People in Africa are not fully aware of what their resources are and of who are the people who are interested in their resources. And much work would be required in order to bring the kind of transparency that we need. to fight this kind of terrorism that is being meted upon us. And I asked, does Africa have the infrastructure to deal with this situation? No, it does not. A few NGOs, one of them that I belong to called Aid Transparency, a group of us have set ourselves up to try to look into the whole issue of aid and what does it really mean? Who benefits from aid to Africa? The Third World Network, Gender and Trade, the African Women Economist that was created by UNIFEM. But all in all, I think what we can say that is very disheartening to see that as we enter the 21st century, we no longer can look forward to that peace dividend to bring peace and to bring development. Instead, we find ourselves faced with a very stifling and strangulating situation. Thank you.
Thank you very much for those remarks, Thelma. I think it's so important for us to remember that this is what the true face of corporate globalization looks like. And that's the story we really don't hear very much here in the U.S., so, okay.
As Kenny said, my name is Adam Mahanit. I come from a small research group called Corporate Europe Observatory based in Amsterdam in Europe. We primarily focus on corporate lobbying, particularly the political power of corporations, as we feel this is a very dangerous element of corporate power in general, in the sense that large transnational corporations have unwieldy influence in our political systems and our democratic institutions worldwide. Some of you may be following the current Enron Anderson scandal. You might have been aware of the General Accounting Office trying to get access to basic information about meetings that Enron officials had with the US government. This is an example of the kind of things that we've been tracking for a number of years in the European Union, which actually has a much more difficult time because actually our laws in the European Union are much more opaque than they are here in the United States, which at least you have some basic procedures you can follow to get access to information, whereas in Europe it's much more difficult. One of the groups that we have focused on in the past and continue to is the World Economic Forum. I just will briefly talk about what it is so that we're all up to speed and get a familiarity with the World Economic Forum. Or some people call it Davos, just as Davos, because traditionally the meeting takes place in a resort, a ski resort in the Alps in Switzerland, in a small village called Davos. Also, it might be interesting to note that partially one of the reasons why the World Economic Forum is in New York is also because they've had a lot of complaints by the local village of Davos who were not very happy having them there anymore. So I think this might be important to note that as well. The WEF is a very strange fish. It is not quite a lobby group. It's not quite just a basic club. It's not a government institution, nor is it an NGO. Nevertheless, it's a fixture in our current global political economy, and it plays a very influential role. It is both formal and informal, and attracts the world's cream of the crop, elites, top corporate and government officials from all over the world. Over some 1,000 to close to 2,000 officials regularly attend. The world's chief executive officers of the largest transnational corporations and government officials, including in the past the President of the United States, Bill Clinton, in his capacity as President, Kofi Annan, and others have also frequented Davos meetings. Also quite unique to the World Economic Forum is the presence of media magnates, representatives, heads of the largest media organizations of the world. Reuters, Financial Times Group, Economist, of course other corporations like General Electric and Westinghouse, which also control large media empires, also are very present there in their capacity as media representatives because they are there to facilitate communicating what's called the Davos Consensus. Now, the Davos Consensus is what is primarily what the WEF tries to do by bringing all these people together. Is that it tries to develop a sort of discourse amongst the global elite that will be a theme or a thematic element of their discourse throughout the year. So getting all these people together, representing the world's largest governments and powers that be, getting together and developing a Davos consensus. Each year, there's a theme to a World Economic Forum meeting. In the past, some of these themes have been called things like strengthening globalization. In the year 2000, it was new beginnings, making a difference. And notably, that was right after the whole Seattle events and everything, so there was a change of theme. It was called something else right before Seattle, and then afterwards they changed the theme. 2001 was called Bridging the Divide and Sustaining Growth, and this year it's called Leadership in Fragile Times. Of course, that was also changed after September 11th. To attend World Economic Forum, you have to be approved by the leadership team led by a person named Klaus Schwab and assistants and other associates who are called WEF partners. And not only do you have to be approved, but you also have to cough up some $25,000. This is an annual fee that you pay for the privilege of attending the meeting. To become a WEF partner, you need to cough up an additional $175,000 to make it a full $200,000, which gives you access to the list of invitees and participants, including all their contact details, in order for you to facilitate making appointments and meetings with key people that you'd like to make deals with during that time. In that sense, Davos is very much like a club for the rich and famous to get together and make deals about mergers, acquisitions, takeovers, negotiations, political developments, and so on. What does it do? Well, the Davos, the World Economic Forum, takes credit for a couple of things, some very important developments in the globalization process. It takes credit for basically steering, in general, it takes credit for steering globalization policy amongst officials and governments in terms of coordinating policy efforts to promote institutions such as the World Bank and the IMF and the World Trade Organization. In fact, the World Economic Forum takes credit for actually helping give birth to the World Trade Organization by successfully bringing parties together to conclude the Uruguay round of negotiations, which led to the creation of the World Trade Organization. Another notable development was that when Kofi Annan visited in 1999, he proposed a global compact with corporations, and which has come under fire recently from a number of critics, including from the Alliance for a Corporate Free UN, which I and others here are members. It also takes credit for successfully minimizing and weakening developing country opposition to a new round in the World Trade Organization. The last few years, meetings with key government trade negotiators from key countries that were opposed to a new round, which was an offensive launched by the United States and the European Union together to push for new issues to be entered into the World Trade Organization. A number of countries were brought together from the sort of focal points of opposition, and as a result of meetings at the World Economic Forum, there was a noticeable shift in policy from countries such as South Africa. After Seattle, the WEF sort of went into an existential crisis of sorts. Klaus Schwab, in his opening address to the meeting, which happened one and a half months after Seattle, said, "We have something of an image problem. It's very difficult to explain to the public who we are." And I think that's kind of an understatement. In fact, we've noticed an approach by the World Economic Forum to kind of open its doors now to some NGOs and artists and other prominent people, in order to make it seem like it's much more open to critics of globalization and developing a dialogue culture, what it calls dialogue culture. Another notable aspect of the World Economic Forum is the fact that attendees of the World Economic Forum are called Davos men, or the Davos man. It's a certain genre or type of person, the kind of elite cream of the crop person who has all the connections and power and so on becomes a Davos man. It's a really prestigious title to be called informally. And it's to some degree, it's quite true, because most of the attendees of the World Economic Forum are in fact men, white men, white, very wealthy men. An interesting comment from one of the critics in the Alternative Forum, which was launched last year and continues today, this year, World Social Forum, there was a dialogue between the two, and in the opening statement by Walden Bellow, one of the people from the World Social Forum, he said this, which I'd like to read out. "We would also like to register our consternation that while we in Porto Alegre have painstakingly come up with a diverse panel of speakers, you in Davos have come up with four white males to face us. But perhaps you are making a political statement." I also note that there was a workshop in the World Economic Forum called Capitalizing on Diversity, so maybe they actually were doing something. I'd like to also stress that the World Economic Forum is not a conspiracy. I don't believe in conspiracies. I believe in institutions. I believe that there's institutional, structural elements that create the problems that we face in our world today. And Davos is an example of that. Davos is an example. It's an institution of the global economy that helps promote globalization policies around the world. As a result, it is not also corporate rule, because governments are very much involved. Government delegations attend World Economic Forum and actively negotiate with corporate associates. So I'd like to clarify that I don't believe that the World Economic Forum is a conspiracy. But because it's not a conspiracy, because it is a fixture in our global political economy, I also believe that it can be changed as a result. There's some feeling of personal ability amongst our part, amongst critics of the World Economic Forum, that we can actually change it and affect change. And because of that, I'm very honored to be here at the Public Eye in Davos and to be a part of that effort to change the culture of the World Economic Forum and the Davos culture, that it's called. It is inherently elitist, it's exclusive, it's feudalistic. It's a dinosaur, and I think it's time that it realized that and fell down and became the fossil that it is. I'd like to comment also, last year I tried to attend the Public Eye in Davos, and because of the extreme police repression that took place in Switzerland, I was actually deported from the country because I wasn't, because I had actually longer hair and I looked like an activist, according to the police, so I wasn't allowed to come in, even though the Swiss president was speaking right before I was, and blah, blah. So here I am again in the same situation. I'm very happy to have finally made it here. And I'd just like to stress that for the Earth Times said that they would like to see solutions coming out of the critics of the World Economic Forum, that, you know, all we do is rant and go on about what's wrong with the world, and, you know, why don't we come up with some solutions? So obviously I haven't done that. My job was to just briefly describe what the World Economic Forum is. But you will see some solutions come up here in the Public Eye in Davos. The fact that there is a Public Eye in Davos is also a solution, because we feel that change, social change, needs to be an inclusive process where ordinary people can come for free and discuss issues that affect their lives. I'd like to stress also that there is this World Social Forum going on where there's some 50,000 people gathered together in Porto Alegre, Brazil, including prominent Nobel laureates and so on, who have been doing a lot of thinking about solutions to the world's problems and have a lot to say. Meanwhile, the WEF, if you, in Klaus Schwab was asked last year, if why is it that more NGOs aren't invited to the World Economic Forum? And he said that those who have something to say will get an invitation. Obviously, none of us here have, or well, some have, but some have refused. And last year's sponsor was McDonald's. This is another little side comment. Last year's sponsor of the WEF was McDonald's, and they had a slogan in Davos, which I thought was very cute. It said, "Think globally, eat locally." And they I'll end on the slogan that's coming up a lot in the protests here in New York and in the World Social Forum, which is then their slogan is, "Another world is possible." And that's what I believe. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Adam, and thank you for so forthrightly admitting that you have an image problem with your long hair, which enables us to know that you are not a Davos man. You are a Seattle man, or perhaps a Porto Alegre man. Okay, now the, thank you for that. The World Economic Forum has had tremendous image problems, obviously, and because of that, they have gone through a process of rebranding. And starting last year, or perhaps before, but certainly by last year, what they were, the rebranding was that the World Economic Forum was some kind of poverty alleviation program, and that all these rich people were going to get together and figure out how to raise standard of living, especially for the poorest people. So thank you for that, and I hope everybody will keep that in mind when they listen to the rhetoric that comes out of the Davos meetings. John Passacantando on my left is the executive director of Greenpeace USA, also the co-founder and director of Ozone Action. He does not have the distinction that Adam has of being deported from Switzerland for trying to attend the Davos meetings, but Greenpeace does have a slightly different distinction. It has attended, the executive director of Greenpeace International has attended the Davos meetings on at least two occasions, last year and the year before. This year they have decided not to go, and they are essentially boycotting the Davos meetings, and John is going to tell us why.
Thank you. First, before I tell this short story on working the inside at the World Economic Forum, I want to take a little vote, and it'll make more sense later. Because you know, in 2000 in Davos, they did a vote, and they said, "How many? What do you think?" They asked all of the Davos men there, "What do you think is the greatest challenge facing you at your industry in the next millennium?" And the answer, the winner of all the threats, was global warming. Okay, so that's where the Greenpeace story begins with Davos. So I just want to know, by a show of hands, how many people, who thinks that the greatest threat in this millennium is the Davos man? Any hands? All right, we'll get back to that later. So, and you know, in defense of the Davos man, I think we might want to consider that, given that we know who they are and what they do today, that perhaps 100 years ago, when these wealthy white men gathered, what they were doing was shooting large animals in Africa and mounting their heads on the walls. So maybe they're better contained at this hotel, but maybe not. All right, so here's the story. In 2000, the executive director of Greenpeace International attended the meeting in Davos. And that is when they did this vote, what's the greatest threat? And, you know, Greenpeace, we're working different coalitions and not really paying attention, and voila, this answer came up, global warming is the greatest threat. We thought, wow, maybe that's an opportunity. Maybe we could really work some of these guys on the inside. You know, as you know, we're Greenpeace, we try a lot of tactics, sometimes on the inside, sometimes hanging on their buildings. And you can guess which ones work better. But it doesn't stop us from trying. So there we were, and we went back to Mr. Schwab, and we said, you know, why don't you pull together the heads of the auto companies from around the world, and we'll bring some experts in and talk about how they can solve global warming. You know, if they say global warming is the greatest threat, well, let's have them solve it. And we brought a great moderator into the discussion, Klaus Töpfer, the head of the United Nations Environmental Program. We brought World Wildlife Fund in with us as well, and we had a one-day meeting presenting, you know, what we thought were the ways they could really begin to reduce worldwide global warming emissions, and, you know, and stop actually changing our weather, you know, which is a small problem, which they actually acknowledged. So we have this meeting, this presentation. People are cordial. They listen. And then they leave, and then various Greenpeacers are trying to follow up, and they're calling the staff at the World Economic Forum. Well, you know, let's follow up with those auto companies. Are they ready to do something? Are they ready to listen? You know, there was a lot of great rhetoric at that meeting. They said, well, it's too early. You don't want to make them nervous. Let's give them a little time. You know, we're still thinking, wow, yeah, but they were enthusiastic. Okay, we'll give them another week or two. A little more time goes by. We call again. And then it's like, you know, bad date gone awry. You know, no return phone calls. So, and then more and more time goes by. And it turns out that the folks at the World Economic Forum have sort of split off with this group of auto companies, and they're continuing to have their own discussions with them about global warming. Well, you know, as the President Villager said in the panel prior to this, that from dialogue grows a sense of responsibility. It can also foster complacency, and unless it's action-oriented. If it's just talk, or worse, if it's a mask for crony capitalism, whether it's the work of the Russian mob or the Houston mob, you know, whether it's Gazprom or Enron, you know, good talk actually can hurt and not help the situation. And so here we were stuck in just this situation, and the response from the World Economic Forum, which actually came in the form of a letter from Mr. Schwab, was that you guys, as in Greenpeace, you came in with concrete demands, and that was a complaint, all right? It was a complaint, not a compliment. And then here's another complaint. The problem with Greenpeace is that you're action-oriented. We didn't realize this was a problem going in. We had a misunderstanding about this meeting. And that the World Economic Forum is just a forum. It's not for action. And then you spoke to the press about what you did. We thought, wow, transparency, yet another problem that we hadn't realized. So they wanted a dialogue and not a set of specific demands, which, you know, they were more than welcome to counter with their own, you know, solution. But, you know, that is, nobody can go into negotiations or a conversation with that without a sort of a set of, you know, solutions. Ironically, Mr. Schwab spoke of this meeting quite extensively too, but he really spoke more as sort of a public relations mouthpiece for the auto industry. And of course, we never intended it to be that way. So when we were invited back again, we chose not to participate anymore and instead focus our resources on the United Nations in the preparatory meeting for the Earth Summit and the meeting down in Puerto Alegre. And so, you know, maybe we'll get into discussions of this later, because we really do, you know, it's one thing, people have a right to assemble, and they have a right to assemble with who they choose to assemble with and to discuss that which they want to discuss. But they have sold the World Economic Forum as this great civil society forum. And if they are going to put it out there in that context, it can't just be greenwashing. But so long as it is, we will steer clear of it and seek other more productive venues to engage the elites. Because there's great hope, and the city shows great hope, in that the whole New York spirit, New York rally from the attacks, is also the spirit that is in many activist hearts, is that it is in the hearts of the peaceful activists, whether they're out on the streets or in this room. And I'm more hopeful for the work being done across the street at the United Nations to prepare for the Earth Summit, to hopefully set that towards a people's agenda, an Earth agenda. And I'll make one final plug, is tomorrow, and there's these large pink flyers in the back, so you can't miss them. There'll be a press conference called The Road from Rio to Johannesburg, the Greenpeace Perspective. It's a critique of where the Earth Summit of 1992 in Rio got off track, and recommendations for where we hope it can go in Johannesburg in August and September later this year. So thank you very much, and thank you for Ion Davos for having me. I'm very honored to be here with all of you.
Thank you very much, John. I think for a lot of us, it's heartwarming to know that as long as Greenpeace is around, there may be dialogue, but it won't stop there. There'll always be action as long as we've got Greenpeace. So that's good to know. John brought up the fact that across the street, in addition to the WEF meeting, that across the street there's an important meeting happening at the United Nations. Our next speaker, Vicky Talikorpus from the Philippines, has been a tireless campaigner at the United Nations to try to strengthen the United Nations, to try to make it a place that can hold corporations accountable and monitor corporations instead of just allowing themselves to wrap their images in the blue flag of the United Nations. She's the executive director of the Tebteba Foundation and an important indigenous leader from the Philippines. She, as I said, a tireless campaigner who spends probably too much of her life on airplanes, but nevertheless, she never fails to provide solidarity and friendship to the rest of us working with her. And Vicky, you're the last speaker, so take it away.
Thank you. Does this work? Yeah. Okay, thank you very much. I'd like also to thank Public Eye again for having me here. I used to be one of the Davos men. I was invited to Davos in 2 years ago, and I really was surprised. How did I ever get invited in that body? But then I realized that most probably the reason why they invited me was because there was a meeting of the International Chamber of Mining Companies Chamber of Commerce. And all the CEOs of the different mining companies were there. And I guess they really wanted to sort of get some kind of information from us who have been actively campaigning against mining corporations, not only in the Philippines, but in other parts of the world, especially as it relates to indigenous mining, indigenous people's communities. So anyhow, I was there, I went. And I had this strange meeting, bizarre actually, meeting with the mining, the CEOs of all these biggest mining corporations in the world, Rio Tinto, Zinc, Newmont, Placer Dome, you know, all these mining companies that you always hear, whether you go to Africa or Asia or Latin America. And in this meeting, basically what they did, they had like a 3 days meeting where they were talking about conflict resolution. And I think that is a recognition that really maybe most of the conflicts in the world today are found in areas where mining operations are taking place. You know, so they gave us dinner, and then we started talking about this issue. So I started sharing with them why we are opposed against mining operations, and I of course related the fact that I come from the Cordillera region in the Philippines. We are indigenous peoples. Our lands contain the wealthiest minerals in the country. In fact, 75% of gold exports from the Philippines come from our region. You know, and this is something that has really destroyed many of the communities who have agreed to open up the mines. And then when our government liberalized their Mining Act, they allowed the entry of all these mining corporations, 100% equity, 100% profit repatriation, tax incentives, all the best incentives that you can think of they're giving to them to attract these mining corporations to come in again. And of course, it has created many problems in lots of communities, like Rio Tinto Zinc wanted to open up a mines among the Subanens in Mindanao. These are an indigenous people's groups. And the Subanens really fought against it. They said, we don't like, this is a community that we would like to keep intact. So they divided the community between themselves. There were lots of struggles. It was militarized. But the people were very staunchly defending it until came a time, after 3 years, Rio Tinto Zinc decided to move out. But they said they were just temporarily moving out. So I was relating this to this group of men. They were all men, but their wives were with them, of course. And then this man says, I think this head of the new man says, oh, but you know, mining only occupies 0.0001% of the land area of the world, and it's not really that problem. So we said, we don't care if the 0.001% is our land, then of course we are concerned. What are you talking about? You're telling us that we shouldn't make this big issue because it's 0.0001%. And anyway, it went on and on, and they said, they said to me, so what do you think? Is it something useful? I said, no, because you might be very good. You are giving me this nice dinner. But when I go back home, all your country offices will behave the same way. They will still continue doing all this pollution in our waters. And they run away when they are being sued. And Placer Dome was the same thing. They polluted one of the rivers in the Philippines, Mindoro. And there were really mine tailings there. This is the main source of food of the people there. And then when the people and the government were going to sue them, they just left, you know. And that's the kind of story that we see. And now it came back to me. I now realize that actually at that meeting, they were already talking about how to contain all these conflicts in indigenous people's communities, in mining areas. And then they are trying to plot out a whole program in which they will really clean up the image of the mining corporations. This is really their main concern, that the image of mining corporations has been so destroyed because of all these anti-mining campaigns, and therefore they want to be looked as the good guys. So now they came up with this whole idea of the Global Mining Initiative, of which one component is the mines, minerals, and sustainable development. And they are now there in the UN across the building. Since the first day, since Monday, Tuesday, and today, they kept on saying that this is a partnership between indigenous peoples and mining corporations. It's a good partnership because we are able to talk to them. And it's all a lie, because I myself, they in fact invited me to become a member of their assurance group, and I refused because I cannot in all honesty be there and say that, you know, I'm speaking on behalf of these people. I have no right to do that, and I cannot bear that kind of responsibility. And so, but anyhow, now they are pushing it, and they're wanting to go all the way to Johannesburg to bring this and bring in the whole issue of sustainable mining, which we all know didn't enter Agenda 21, because there's no such thing. I haven't seen in my life any sustainable mining experience, you know. So anyway, this is really the whole agenda. So just to link that to what's happening now at the WEF, I'm convinced that this WEF is really the body where people come together, these corporations come together, sort of look into the problems that they are faced with, in which they are not able to do whatever they like to do, and then deal with the heads of states who are there. There are heads of states who are going there. Some UN agencies go there, the heads of UNDP, UNEP, Kofi Annan goes there, you know. And sort, this is sort of a forum where people come together and they will try to sort of work out how do we deal with all these problems. But of course, because the corporations are the dominant, they are the ones who are really calling the shots there, that is dealing the problems from their own perspective. And that is what's happening at the WEF. And that is what we really should protest against, because that is where the WTO was born. And now that is where they are now pushing for the negotiation of new agreements again in the WTO. And the number one agenda that they have, insofar as the WTO is concerned, is to liberalize investments. And this is so they would like to negotiate again a new treaty on investments, which is like the failed multilateral agreement on investment. They are going to bring it again, and they succeeded to a certain extent in Doha to bring this into agenda, that the negotiations are going to start. I was also in Doha, and I saw how they really manipulated, they blackmailed most of the countries who were protesting against it. The Philippine government came to me and told me that at 3 o'clock in the morning, this WTO called the Philippines to a room, small room, and started pressuring them not to push their agenda on this whole issue of agricultural subsidies and all that, and they were trying to divide the Philippines and Thailand. So they put Thailand in one room, and they told these Thais that, oh, the Philippines is negotiating with the EU in the other room. You know, thank goodness the Philippine minister, the trade minister, already knew about it, and then he said, I'm not going to talk to you. I want the Thais to be here because this is an issue that we have. Then the Thais went in, and they were so angry, they were knocking at the door. They thought that the Philippine minister was selling out the whole thing. So that's the kind of thing that you see in Davos from that time when they started pressuring all the countries to agree to the final agreement of Doha. You know, I'm sorry. But that's, and this is really, these are the corporations who are there. The corporations who were supporting the Doha ministerial meeting were Exxon, Mobil, General Motors, you know, all these key players who are also in the WEF, you know. So I think it's really important for us to really be very strong in our position to call really for a stop to this new round that they are trying to bring in again. And also to call for this corporate accountability that we are pushing for, you know, this demand that there should be a convention on corporate accountability. I think we should really be very strong on this. I would just like to end by saying, you know, it's for me, it's really, I think the crime the travesty, I would say, that's happened in our lifetime is that people like us who live in the wealthiest part of the world in terms of resources, we find that we are the poorest people, and we find that these are the areas where conflict is. And really the reason is that, I mean, you know, we are just good insofar as we are allowing these resources to be extracted. You know, we are allowing all this, whether mineral, oil, gas, or biological resources, we just are going to provide all these raw materials, and we will never see the day where we are able to process these materials ourselves in a sustainable way and use it for our own interest to develop our own communities. And I think that's really the situation that we find ourselves more and more in. We knew that 30 years ago, it's still happening now, but it's even worse now because these resources are getting fewer and fewer, you know, and unfortunately, most of these fewer resources are found in indigenous people's lands because we have been the ones fighting against them and claiming that we have rights over our territory, etc. Most of these are found in indigenous people's lands, so we will be seeing more and more conflicts because of the competition over the control over these resources. And the WEF is a body that brings together all these people who will bargain, who are wheeling and dealing to get all the best deals so that they will be able to come freely into our countries, get their rights as investors enshrined in our constitution because this is the WTO agreement on international on investment, and then at the same time continue violating the rights of indigenous peoples, of women, of farmers, you know, of workers, continue violating their rights and giving the rights to these biggest and the most powerful players in the globalization arena. So I think that is really the picture that we see now, and the challenge for all of us is to really fight against this kind of monopolization, fight against this continuing domination that they are doing to do, and we will be able to do this by strengthening the UN and pushing for the UN not to be caught in the clutches of these corporations. This campaign that we're launching, this Kenny is so modest, but this is a book which he did, which really identifies all the human rights, you know, the violations of these corporations insofar as the principles of the Global Compact are found. And we also have here, we put together an alliance for a corporate free UN, because we don't think that the UN should be a body where the corporations go. They have the WEF, they have all the bodies in the world, you know, they have all the international, they have all the chambers of commerce, and this, the UN is only the place left for little people to come and really say that our rights should be respected and should be promoted and be respected by both states, governments, and corporations. So I think we need to be very strong on that, because unless we strengthen the UN not to be co-opted by all these corporations, then I think the only chance for us is to just strengthen our local struggles in the local level and join hands together. And I hope that the World Social Forum in Porto Alegre will really be able to consolidate all the different movements in the world to be able to have a very strong voice against all these corporations and the most powerful nations who are also backing these corporations. Thank you very much.
Vicky, thank you for your eloquence, for your inspiration, and also thank you for the commercial for my report, which is available on one of the back tables. Well, I guess the WEF is a cocktail party on steroids, and maybe the cocktail party aspect or the informal aspect they talk about as being one of the most important parts where they get to network. Well, we don't have the cocktails here, but I'd like to try to make the rest of our time as informal and as productive as possible by reducing speeches and just having, as I know there's a lot of people here, it's not going to be easy, but having as many people make comments and questions for the panel and also reactions to the panelists as informally and as quickly and as inclusively as we can. So I think, because we took a little more time than I'd hoped, I'm going to go straight to reactions and questions from the audience, starting with this gentleman standing over there.
I'm asking Madam Andy, I put out the undiplomatic times. I also edit disarmament times for the NGO committee on disarmament, security, and peace. And taking cue from the last speaker, she said we have to strengthen the United Nations. I think you have to address yourself to how do you strengthen the United Nations. And a critical area in which it needs strengthening is the area of reporting reality as it exists, and not reality as it wants it to exist. If you look at UN reports, there are two key areas in which there is no global reporting at all. And one is the military situation in the world, and the other is the human rights situation in the world. On both those areas, you're dependent on a few non-governmental organizations and a few governments to provide the information. And so there is no comprehensive reporting of reality. There is no single report in the entire history of the UN that looks at the linkage between, for instance, human rights, development, and security. There is not a single report. The annual report of the Secretary General on the work of the organization, which is meant to do this, has always been a scissors and paste job. So if you're looking at strengthening the UN, a key area is to demand reality in its reports.
Thank you very much, Dr. Chairman. Yes.
Yeah, I'm Kai Kalevar. I was here on September 11, and I'm back here again. One thing that occurred to me in this period of time is Greenpeace has phenomenally failed in stopping global warming, and I don't blame you for that. At the same time, I should say that what happened on September 11 did make a dent on global warming by cutting down on the airplane flights. So let's not forget that, for those who are action-oriented. But anyway, I don't advocate that, but at the same time, it's a fact of life, we should know it. Again, in terms of strengthening United Nations, I am working with a group where what we are trying to do is trying to get a second house in the United Nations where it is directly elect representatives to United Nations, and it will have a legislative power. Unless we do that, and even that election process should be saved from corporations, we know that, but at least we should try to do that, a second house where we have direct elections. Only then United Nations will be able to hopefully rule on the world corporations. Because right now, the corporations rule Washington, and Washington rules the world. And that is a problem that we must solve, not only in the United States, but everywhere else. So I hope you keep that in mind.
Thank you very much. Interesting initiative. Go ahead.
Carol Chase, ombudsperson for the UN. An ombudsperson is one who holds officials accountable for human rights violations. A year ago, I was at the battle in Seattle, and the battle in Seattle was a pivotal point in political history because there were people from the Southern Hemisphere, developed countries, and they were with Americans, and they were savvy. They went to the jugular vein of how the world really operates. the Jekyll Island Ultra Club, the World Bank, Bretton Woods Institutions, the IMF, they identified the source of our problem or the obstacles. And what is needed when they, at the sequel, the parade that went around Lake Hill and all around was a huge banner for a people's assembly. And this is important because American foreign policy needs to be reviewed. Critical issues need to be addressed, and they're not. So if we had in the trusteeship council, if we demanded to amend only four articles, we could get the trusteeship council at the UN, a people's assembly, have it outfitted with huge screens, going to each region of the earth, and where the people talk to people at the mother's house on critical issues. We need to use and invoke the charter. We the people determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war. We are now on the brink of World War III. On September 11th, there was 9/11, Wake Up America. There, 11, 12, 13, 14th, all of a sudden Congress had passed 420-1, a declaration of war in which the president can take action and authorize the use of force. Where's the dialogue? We need to use the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Article 19, and demand information, demand due process. And we need to demand a people's assembly where the people, and we have to keep Time Warner, CNN, the Bretton Woods institutions at bay. They have their say in the General Assembly and in the Security Council. But we, the people, determined to save our children from the brink of World War III, we must realign to the Charter. And we should also, I think, invoke Article U's, Article 100. Kofi Annan is under the thumb of the U.S. State Department.
Yes, he is.
He is not aligned with the Charter. He should be removed from office, and he should be brought forth before the International Criminal Court on crimes against peace, and invoke the 1949 Geneva Convention. We need to be firm, and we need an international mechanism in order to do this. We need a People's Assembly. We can do it in the Trusteeship Council, but we must keep the Bretton Woods institutions at bay and claim our airwaves, the vast global commons. We are not getting information. There's so much information that sits on the third floor that never gets out. We need to demand it. Invoke Article 19. EPA Commissioner Whitman is not giving us information about the vital air quality. It's deathly down there. We are not getting information about the air quality. Use the Charter, realign to the Charter, invoke Article 19, invoke Article 100, and amend those four articles so that we get a People's Assembly in the Trusteeship Council. We need that international mechanism in order to have dialogue with people, which is what we want.
Thank you so much for that. Carol must be a heck of an ombudsperson, I think, at the UN. Thank you. Yes.
Okay, hi. My name is Kevin Chi. I'm a local New York City resident involved in grassroots movement right here in New York City. I think in regard to your question at the beginning about why the anti-globalization movement here in this room might not be more diverse, I think it's because sometimes those participants in it forget the slogan that Greenpeace used so effectively, think globally, act locally. And the reason that more people of color in the United States are not involved in these struggles is because of the disconnect in the movement, in terms of, because many issues that were talked about at this forum today are actually faced by many people of color here at home in the United States as well. For example, I work with many garment workers and restaurant workers in Chinatown working under these sweatshop conditions that are proliferating in many parts of the world and are now on their way to Africa as the latest place for where the garment industry hopes to operate. But until such anthropology problem, environmental racism, which permeates many low-income communities in general across the United States, I think it therefore is very important for citizens of the United States to be able to connect with what's going on in that backyard and tie into the larger problem of what's going on around the world with this corrupt system of globalization, which is really just either one can see as either the new imperialism or just the old imperialism cloaked under a different form and a different name. And I guess in terms of a commentary, I guess I actually study law as well, and I'm a future lawyer, I guess. And actually, the interesting thing about corporations is that they were so, and I believe this is a corporate law in most countries, is that they're supposed to be creatures of the state. They are, you know, they're given charters that have the right to exist, you know, and that therefore, technically, the state attorney generals of the of any state in the United States where a corporation is chartered have a right to revoke the charter of a corporation for human rights violation. And I know that some scholars have talked about why not multinational corporations should therefore be charters revoked if they cannot be found, say, legally liable, because it's very ironic, as Enron shows, that, you know, corporations might talk about the need, that, you know, the need to deregulate, where they're constantly, you know, exploiting, you know, local governments, you know, through their middle persons in different countries, you know, the, to get at their precious resources. So I think definitely there needs to be a lot of organizing done in the local level while looking at creative legal means, whether at the UN or within each government body. And I would love to hear a commentary from any panelists on the, this.
Okay, thank you very much. I think, as you requested, I think we'll take a minute now. We'll get back to all of you folks, but just take a moment now to see if any of the panelists want to react to any of the statements that were made. Vicky,
yeah. Yeah, I actually would like to react to the first point that was raised about strengthening the UN. Really, what has happened after September 11, I mean, you know, we know, all of us would know that there's after September 11, there's a totally different world now. And really the thinking is in terms of, you know, legitimizing these kinds of operations post September 11 is really the thing that's permeating many of the negotiations, in fact, that are happening. I remember in Doha, the opening statement of Mike Moore was that, you know, this September 11 event has happened because there is a too much poverty in the world, and there is too much poverty because there is not enough globalization. So if you think that you're coming here to stop globalization, then you are really aligning yourselves with these terrorists, you know. So that kind of logic is the logic that's being spread around, and then of course we heard the UN, some UN officials saying that when we're talking about security, now we're talking about failed states, and these are the states who cannot provide education, who are not able to address their problems of poverty. And if these states, these kinds of states, are breeding grounds for terrorists, you know. So if that state is a breeding ground for terrorists, then any country can intervene to prevent, you know, the development of new terrorists. And I think this is very dangerous. And in fact, I would just like to, in the Philippines right now, that's the justification. They said that we have the Al-Qaeda. Now we have like $400 million are sent as military aid, and there are like 600 U.S. military officers now in the Philippines joining the operations in the south. And this is, of course, something that's going to cause massive violations of human rights again. And fortunately, in our country, there's really huge protests every day fighting against this. But that is the kind of scenario that we are going to see more and more, in which this UN official said, we're not just talking of countries like Iraq or Iran, we are talking of countries like Egypt, Malaysia, Philippines, Indonesia, you know. So I think this is the new danger that we are seeing right now, that on the name of, you know, of fighting against terrorism, they will justify the intervention, you know, physically and of course with funds on our countries. And if we are not going to say very strongly to the UN that they should not be the ones who are just cleaning up the mess after the US comes and bombs all these countries, that is not their role as the UN. Their role is really to maintain peace, to promote peace, and not to be the ones who will clean up the mess after the bombing operations of these powerful countries.
Mm-hmm. Adam?
Is this working?
Hello?
Yeah, okay. I just wanted to bring it back a little bit to the World Economic Forum. With the point that came up about indicators and truth, basically, what is actually happening in the world. I'll give you an anecdote of one of the things that came out of the last World Economic Forum, which was the Environmental Sustainability Index, which was launched by the World Economic Forum spin-off group called the Global Leaders for Tomorrow. They announced in very big fashion, which was taken up by most of the mainstream media, a new Environmental Sustainability Index, which actually tried to make the case, which I think Vicky kind of illustrated very succinctly, that economic growth and wealth equals sustainability. There's no question about it. And in the index, it listed, it basically said that the most responsible, environmentally responsible and socially responsible countries in the world are also the wealthiest. So all of a sudden you have like the United States and European Union countries, most of the OECD countries, at the top of the list. And at the bottom of the list, of course, were all the really poor countries from Africa and Latin America, the least developed countries of the world. But research done by Friends of the Earth and the New Economics Foundation, both independent of each other, came up with the same conclusion. The method that they used to come up with these indications was that they completely ignored consumption patterns, so you know consumption of fossil fuels, for example, and so on. They completely ignored things like the amount of emissions of industries owned by foreign companies in the developing world, which are of course used as a way to repatriate profits back to the north. They also ignored all of the sort of political policies imposed by the World Bank, the IMF, and the World Trade Organization, and others, which imposed certain structural adjustments on these countries and forced them to abide by certain really strict rules about how they can spend their money and on what and where, and most of it goes to exporting and so on, and very unsustainable things. So overall, they added in all these factors, and they actually found that the opposite was true, that Uganda and other countries were at the top of the list, and that the United States and the European Union countries were at the bottom because of you add in all these important factors, which are completely ignored. So I think your point is really true, and it's really important to, in the case of the World Economic Forum, that we see that there is so much effort on the part of the proponents of corporate-led globalization to distort the facts and to distort the reality, to make us believe that actually if we follow their prescriptions, everything will be okay. And one of the most important things that we can do as normal individual people is to be critical of all the information that we see, wherever it comes from, whether it comes from an NGO, or whether it comes from governments and corporations, and hold them to account and take them to task on things which are simply not true, and bring it out and develop different indices that reflect the reality. And another point about this question of world governments and parliamentary assemblies and so on, I think the intention of it is quite noble, but I think the real problem in terms of globalization is that more and more, most of the decision-making powers of countries, most of the decisions that are being made in the world are actually happening in a more centralized fashion on a global level, on an international level or intergovernmental level. This could be reflected through, when we talk about deregulation, we don't really mean deregulation of the economy. Sometimes we're actually talking about re-regulation, because the World Trade Organization, for example, is a very rules-based system which has regulations about how one can conduct trade and restrict trade and so on. So I think it's really important that we first analyze that we already have, to some degree, a world government. That is the institutions that promote corporate-led globalization, the World Bank, the IMF, multilateral development banks, transnational corporations themselves, and of course, World Trade Organization. And so in my opinion, and this is just my opinion, I don't think that having another world body centralized very far away from ordinary people is perhaps the best solution. I think the problem with globalization is that democracy is eroding, and that democratic control over our lives needs to be restored back down to the individual person, that we need to have much more individual democratic control over the way our lives are governed. So I think, although I agree that there needs to be some kind of international rules which can regulate some of the worst excesses of corporate power abuse and so on, such as the Corporate Accountability Convention that some of you have heard about. I think also part of the solution is that we need to really strengthen our local democratic initiatives to restore control on a local level so that people themselves are much more empowered to make decisions.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Let's move.
Okay, I wanted to ask Vicky. Vicky, you talked about the Doha, Qatar meeting of the World Trade Organization, and last week I was at the Financing for Development conference at the UN, and I heard for the first time a little bit about what happened right at the end of that meeting, where India evidently stood very firmly against a new round, and other countries were sort of in the background, but India insisted that it was going nowhere until they got one sentence, I guess, which they got at the very end, which said, we will not go another step forward until there is explicit consensus of the countries. That, I think, needs to be, people need to know that, because it was such a hopeless, felt like such a hopeless meeting. I was really glad to hear Martin Kaur tell us that last week.
You want to quickly respond? Before you respond, can I ask one of the organizers to get to bring up some more water? Thank you.
What happened at the Financing for Development was that the EU wanted the Doha agreements to be brought here and actually be reinterpreted in a way, you know, because and in Doha, what happened was the Doha Declaration contained this, there will be negotiations on the four Singapore issues, which is on investment agreement, on competition, government procurement, and trade facilitation. These are the four issues. And what the EU did was to bring that draft that declaration here, but they didn't bring the chairman's text, which was actually the one that was clarifying that we cannot start negotiations until there is explicit consensus among the members of the WTO. Okay, and what the EU did was to sneakily bring it inside here, not bring the chairman's text, you know, and then trying to convince these people here that this is really what the Doha declaration meant, you know. Fortunately enough, we got the EU paper before it was even brought out, so we were able to pinpoint where were the problems here. First of all, there is no such thing as a Doha development round in the statement. There was no mention of really negotiations, you know, and this is the chairman's text which qualifies it. And I think that whole experience, we were at least somehow we managed to damage control it. So now if you see the final text, it doesn't contain all the most dangerous things that we saw earlier there about calling for a negotiation of an investment treaty, you know, and all that. But nevertheless, what this tells us is that we should be very vigilant, because they will do this again in the WSSD. They will try to bring this because they knew that the negotiators here in New York don't really know very much about trade, because this is done in Geneva. No, so if it so happened that the NGOs like Third World Network wasn't here during that time, who were in Doha, then nobody would have known. Even the G77, we spoke to them and they said, we do not know this, we don't know about this whole issue, you know. So I think that's really the good role that NGOs should be playing, because we have the privilege of being able to move from one forum to another and then put all those kinds of linkages and trying to block all the attempts that they will do to bring in back again their issues in these events.
Yeah, tell me you want to say something. I think use this one.
Thank you. I'd just like to respond to the point that was made by Adam. And it's about institutions. I think we need institutions. If you look at what's happening right now with the whole other side of defense, they have established some excellent institutions. I mean, institutions that are very efficient and that do what they are supposed to do very well. The World Bank, the IMF, the WTO, and by the time we can collect ourselves to really oppose one, another one gets created, which is even stronger and more oppressive. And we, on the other hand, talk about, well, get more democracy so people can say more. It's true, but you need strong institutions to do the same kind of work in terms of putting our point forward and making sure our agenda goes forward as you have from the other side. And let me say that in Africa, we really feel that the institutions that we had which were trying to do that, like the UN Economic Commission for Africa, for instance, which was a voice that would put out an alternative to World Bank policies, was appropriated. And so we have no spaces anymore where we can do our own thinking. and come up with our own demarche, so to speak.
Thank you. Yes, step up to that mic.
Hello, my name is David Berner. I'm with the anti-WTO coordination from Switzerland. And I've been involved with the protests in Davos over the past 5 years. We have organized their protests. We heard before that they had been banned. It wasn't even possible for people from the public eye on Davos to get up there to Davos. Now, our position towards the World Economic Forum is that we are not looking to dialogue with them. It's not that we don't want to dialogue with the different groups and different people, but we think that it doesn't make any sense because the way the dialogue, the way they mean it, is just for public relations. We've seen it before when Kaspar Filiger, the president of Switzerland, was here. He comes here, he says, I'm here to listen what's going on, and he holds a statement. Then there's a reaction from Paul Natua, from Friends of the Earth, and he doesn't say anything about it, and he leaves. He didn't come here to listen. He came here to have his face. So in the Swiss media especially, it will be portrayed like the Swiss president was there to talk to the anti-globalization movement. So I think it's very, we have to think really much when there's going to be meeting and who are we meeting with, and if there is any accountability about that, or if it just serves them. So I think it's really important that Greenpeace decided not to go to the World Economic Forum, and I think people who get invited there so they have their faces, so the CEOs can make pictures with like the opponents to put up their image, is a problem. So we really have to think if we go to meetings and if it serves anyone.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's someone who fixed it before. We've got that feedback problem again. So thank you, technical expert. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to respond to what this young man said about he's locally from New York and raising questions. I am as well. And as somebody who is not a person of color, not working class background, educated, white, I struggle with these things all the time. And I think it's really important to strengthen the UN by reclaiming it in the name of some kind of people's organization. And all the suggestions that have been made here were very enlightening to me because I think about that as well. And also the whole issue of the activist organizations making a decision not to try to dialogue with the world financial organizations. But I think you need to be clear that the reason that you can't do that is because you don't have any power to do that. And I think not because they come up with their PR stuff, because they're going to always do that. I mean, that's what they do. And until we can develop some kind of bottom-up kind of vision and structure and process, so that what we're constantly doing here is developing ourselves as local, global people, we're always going to be faced with that. With that situation, and I'm not sure about making alternative suggestions. This person did, Kevin did make those alternative suggestions, and there are all kinds of ideas about community labor organizations, and it's very difficult for white educated people in these movements for us to think that we are actually local people, that we deserve communities, we deserve daily lives. That are connected to the earth. We can talk about it and abstract about it, but for us to actually act on that in ourselves and in our relations to each other, it's a challenge. And I would hope to think that I'm part of changing that. But I also wanted to mention the other guy who talked about the fact that about the end of global warming because of 9/11. Of course, that's just totally weird. But I was in. Well, it isn't totally weird though. I mean, that's the problem. That's what we're faced with now. We are faced with these enormously complex contradictions that are really wacko. When I was in Blue Ridge Mountains, and I was I hung out with people in environmental groups there. The Blue Ridge Mountains is a flyway from Dulles Airport, and because there were no planes, the wildlife is coming back. Because the noise, the wildlife depart because of the noise, and a lot of people do too, where wildlife do. So, I mean, those are incredible contradictions that we have to face, and that we know that structure is never going to deal with those, but we have to deal with them. And so we had better understand that unless we have some kind of locally connected dialogues and inclusion in these things, that we're not going to get there. We can't continually demonize these institutions and expect that that's where our solidarity is, because it isn't. Thank you.
Okay, we've been going almost an hour and a half now, so I'd like to take one or two, maybe two more comments from the floor, and some very quick last reactions from the panel. Yes. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm Nick Cooper with the Houston Independent Media Center, and I just wanted to ask, I was hearing a little bit about some principles like the UN Declaration of Human Rights, and I suppose we could talk about the US, the Bill of Rights. And I was wondering that if the appeal to these declarations begins to have less or no meaning in the absence of community empowerment. Certainly in the United States, there are advertised motifs like science will overcome all the problems of our excesses, or that the financial success of the United States is a result of our superior democracy or something, that are more powerful than any of these declarations in terms of having a hold on people's minds. And I think that they make community empowerment more difficult. And I was wondering if any of the panelists had a response to the limitations of invoking these principles, such as the UN Declaration of Human Rights, among people that really don't have any rights like that.
Okay, thank you. Is this off now? Yeah. I'm going to ask the panelists to respond to that if they can, but just to hold off another second. Last one or two. Yes, go ahead.
I think I think somebody responded to this, so democracy is under threat and all that, and that's really true. And when I say that you should have a global people's assembly or directly elected second house at the United Nations, it's not to undermine the local or decentralized democracy that is possible. But on the other hand, it is to claim a public space for discourse which is not provided by World Trade Organization, IMF, and World Bank. I think that is the problem. What has happened, in effect, is that the World Trade Organization is right now more powerful than the United Nations General Assembly. I mean, that's the reality. The private space is more powerful than the public space, except, of course, for the UN Security Council, which has a very limited role. So I think we have to assert the public space over the private space. And the big problem in democracy as it stands, as I see, lies with the fact that the democracy of the people, by the people, for the people, has been hijacked by the corporations. The corporations have tremendous financial power, and they have eternal life, which we don't do have. And their eternal life and financial power means that they pretty well rule, and they are ruling. So what we need to do is put the genie back in the bottle. And the way to do, I suggest, is that we should ask and we should try to get a sunset clause on all corporate charters. I think till we get a sunset clause on corporate charters, the corporations have no reason to come back to the public to say, hey, Can we do this or can we do that? They, we should have, we should demand in their annual reports a report on human rights, a report on environment, and that there should be a separate human rights auditor and an environment auditor and so on. Till we are able to enforce these expectations on these corporations which are running amok for a very long time, I think we are not getting anywhere. So let's try doing that. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, last comment from the floor.
Hi, I have two sets of comments. I'll be as brief as possible. One is regarding what was said about 9/11 and its unintended consequences on biodiversity and climate change. I think that's a very strange association to make, and perhaps I can make another that might show the people who made those comments how strange and potentially offending they can be. I lived in a village along the Zambia-Angola frontier for quite a while. Because of the war in Angola, it had wonderful effects on biodiversity. It also had some pretty bad effects on missing limbs and huge human sufferings. I don't think we want to link those things. That's the first comment. Of course, in Zambia, there was no war, so there was no forest, but the limbs did a lot better. The other comment I'd like to make is about what we are doing here. We have a group of NGOs from American and others, and I think a lot of what we're talking about, these local participation, mobilizing people, building alliances, is already being done in other places. The Democratic Party does it. The Republican Party does it. It's very difficult for third parties in this country, but I don't know why we don't talk about these things in a political way. We talk about NGO activism, civil society. This is politics. I think we should do this as a party. I currently live outside the US, and I find it amazing. I live in Portugal, where you have parties that, in terms of national representation, win less than, have won less than what the Green Party, and I'm a member of the Green Party in the US, did in the last election, but they are household names. You see them on TV all the time. That doesn't happen yet. I think bring our issues together. We need to contribute to parties. We're all working in these thousands and thousands of NGOs, but in fact, apart from our own commitment, we have no mandate. We have no public supporting us. And why is that? Because we're not involved in traditional politics, and it's very important, no matter how hard it is in this country to do so, to re-energize, work with unions. You know, there is a reason why, I mean, Europe is not that much different in terms of corporate power than the US. You still have communist parties. You have, in Portugal, a Marxist-Leninist party. They work very hard. They're not doing that well, but they work hard, and they have a lot of support. They never get very far up in terms of the parliament. They have a few representatives. But in local councils, they have successes all over the country. I really think we need to, you know, sort of go backwards maybe. You know, in the US, we have all these NGOs, and we've exported this NGO model. I think they're wonderful. I think they should continue. But I think we need to start are acting in the political sphere so that we are not just single-issue NGOs or local NGOs that work on one issue or another issue, would have all these wonderful committed people, but we are a movement. And I think to be a movement, you need to act politically, no matter how corrupt our system might be, no matter how many problems we might have with PACs and financing of campaigns. I think we need to get in there and agitate a little more than just these things. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for that. I just, as a moderator, want to say I'm assuming that the comment that was made earlier, no, I don't think anybody was meaning to condone the September 11th attacks because of some coincidental collateral benefit that might have happened, like they think the skyline looks better now or people took less plane rides. So I would ask, let's not follow that. I don't think that's what the gentleman meant, and I don't think we should follow down that. But I would like to give our panelists, any who wish to, a chance to share some final thoughts.
Okay, the only final thought I have is, you know, what we're talking about here is how do you build power to counter the power that we see across the street, And it's just the way we do it at Greenpeace, the way that I've always tried to do it is you're always looking for peaceful ways to go after these companies one at a time, to try to find ways to keep Ford from selling their automobiles, to try to find ways to keep Exxon from selling their oil, Monsanto from selling their seeds, General Electric from selling whatever the heck it is they sell, because when they feel that pressure one at a time, they do change. It is hard to make them change when they're all clustered together in a hotel. That is not necessarily where they make change. It is where we can drive symbolic actions and frame a debate. But we power does come from when we can drive them to make change one at a time, when we can keep them from selling to us what they are in business to sell to us. And the other thing I wanted to comment on to the gentleman from the Swiss group that opposes Davos, and I appreciate their work. And I would just say that for any group that tries to work on the inside, as Greenpeace has tried in the past with the World Economic Forum, the one thing that sort of can protect you in doing that is transparency. So we could lay out reports to you and say, this is exactly what we asked the car companies to do. This is what the response was. It didn't work, but here's what we tried. It's just, if you just don't want to be a group that tries to engage a group like that in secrecy. And so that would be my only comment on trying to engage efforts like that, whether you're on the inside or the outside. Transparency sets you free. Thank you all. Mm-hmm. Excuse
me. I would just like to say that, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. That coming from Africa, we feel that we have really seen the worst aspects of globalization. We've seen the worst parts of the beast. We know the pain that results from it, and sometimes we are not sure where it's coming from. But I want to really emphasize, and I agree with the speaker before the last who spoke about the need for institutions such as parties. We need to get out there and use the same kinds of instruments that can take parts of the power and use it to play. We need alternative sources of finance that people who do not want to participate in the present structure of finance can have access to in order to do the things that need to be done. And we need a new ideology, because right now the mantra that we hear coming from the World Bank that you can't even dare say something against before someone raises their little eyebrow at you, and that's the mildest you would get. We need a new ideology that will really we can hang our stars to and move forward.
Is this on?
Yeah.
Okay. I think there's a number of important points that came up, and there's really interesting debate developing here, and it's a pity that we couldn't pursue it further about the nature of democracy and what's needed. And this is the kind of solutions that I think are going to be heard more from during the rest of this Public Eye event and in the World Social Forum and on the streets. So I welcome that, and I really think it's very useful that we do have these discussions. I'll just make some comments. I live in Europe at the moment, and for those of you, I used to live in the United States, so I know how weird Europe can seem from the United States perspective. But Europe is very complex. It's going through a very complex institutional changes at the moment. What we see going on in European Union at the moment is a centralization of power, mimicking the kind of centralization of decision-making powers we see in global economy. And this is all in an effort to supposedly be more efficient and to be a one big happy family kind of feeling that a lot of people are being told is the nature of the European Union project.